Welcome back to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Think climate change is too serious to joke about? Well, consider this. With each new scientific report, the situation seems to get more dire. But the social and political will to address the issue has lagged. For years, scientists and communicators thought the problem was that the facts weren't getting through to the public. But years of research suggest the obstacle may be more fundamental, an issue of how we talk about climate change and science more broadly. And that has led some researchers to experiment with some pretty unorthodox ways to break through the inertia and polarization surrounding climate change. For example,
you know the way those scientists are always trying to pull a fast one on us? Oh, you rapscallions. Fool me once, and then prove it over and over and over again. Have it reviewed by your peers until it's a fact.
Max Boykoff is an associate professor of environmental studies and director of the Center for Science and Technology Policy Research at the University of Colorado Boulder. He's also author of Creative Climate Communications. Max, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much for having me on the show.
You've been studying climate communication for about 20 years. And if we go back about 20 years, a lot of what was being said about climate change communication was scientists are failing to get enough facts across to the American public. That's what is going wrong in this process, and we've got to do better at communicating the facts. At what point did you realize that hammering home facts and really dire worst-case scenarios about climate change was, in fact, not working and was barking up the wrong tree to some extent?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think I learned that fairly early in the work that I did. I started to investigate these issues from a social sciences perspective. And just as you're saying, it's this notion of information deficit that people would cling to, thinking that if we just could give them some more facts, throw out some more reports into the public space, that everyone's going to do the right thing. But I learned, I think, pretty early that we live complex lives. We're complex people. And so that is what, you know, motivated me in part to start to then investigate for the last nearly 20 years how to more effectively communicate and essentially connect with people under different conditions and with different audiences.
And you point out that there's been another side effect of ineffective climate communication besides the fact that decades later we are still not where we should be in terms of reducing greenhouse gas emissions or even having the degree of consensus that one might expect among the American public that climate change is happening and is human caused. That besides that main effect of ineffective climate communication, there's been a secondary effect, which is kind of a social acceptance of not talking about climate change at all.
Mm-hmm. You're right. I mean, there are many effects. There isn't just the one secondary effect, of course, but that's a big one. We have retreated into these spaces of virtual climate silence. And in the United States context in particular, this is often a partisan, polarized issue. And so people tend to avoid those sorts of things. But we've allowed ourselves to avoid what turns out to be one of the greatest, most challenging issues of our time in the 21st century. And so it is there is this real need for this movement from that 20th century model of communication that you had described well in your previous question, which is hitting people over the head with facts and science, into a 21st century communications model, which is dialogue, which starts with conversation, starts with listening to other points of view and opening up new pathways to understanding and engaging with these issues. And so that can be experiential, talking with people about how they've experienced a changing climate during their lives. It can be through aesthetics, engaging more with the arts and the creative spaces. It can be through emotions and affective ways of learning and knowing. That's actually been an area that I've been collaborating with others on to understand how humor perhaps can leverage these spaces to open up conversations and lower defenses and get people talking about it as a vehicle for greater engagement in action.
Max Boykoff, as you describe those different kind of modes of communication, experiential, emotional, do you see that as separate from scientific, or is there a way to combine those two to talk about climate science in an experiential or an emotional way? How connected are they?
Yeah, they're absolutely connected. I think it's a mistake to think of them as completely separate, because the way in which we understand a changing climate largely comes from the great work that's been done over the last decades within the sciences. It's really to complement and then help that work go farther. In the book, I talk about 10 different kind of features of a roadmap and rules of the road, essentially guidance on how we can smarten up the way that we talk about climate change in order to improve the effectiveness of greater engagement. And Steve Schneider, who was a really successful climate communicator in his lifetime, who was at Stanford University for a long time, the National Center for Atmospheric Research, he basically summed it up in terms of knowing thy audience, knowing thyself, but knowing thy stuff. And so we definitely don't want to separate out all of this scientific information from these other pathways that I described. In fact, they can help support and fortify and enrich those discussions.
When it comes to knowing thy audience, does that mean that it is possible to get a climate change message through to anyone if you use the right approach? I mean, I think the thinking, the prevailing wisdom has almost become at this point that there are certain people, certain groups of people for whom climate change is just never going to resonate. It's not going to work. Do you think that's true, or is that just a blind spot in our communication strategies?
I think there's always a pathway in. For people who may have seen the book, you'll have seen that climate in the title of Creative Climate Communications is in parentheses. I do that for two reasons. One, I wrote it as a book that can be about creative communications about other science and policy issues. But to your question, secondly, I wrote it because sometimes effective communications and creative communications may involve not invoking the terms climate or climate change explicitly. Hmm. We know probably in our own lives that sometimes those raise people's defenses. Instead, there are many other ways that you can talk about this issue. And this is in no way to suggest that we shy away from confronting this challenge. In fact, the scale of the response collectively to date is nowhere near commensurate to the scale of the challenge that we're facing. But we can talk about this in other ways, like resilience, like stewardship of our planet. And that can open up pathways to talking about it through religion, for instance. We can talk about it through what kind of legacy do we want to leave for future generations. We can talk about it through local air and water quality. Talk about it, I think, importantly, through public health and the health of our kids. I even think that we could start productive conversations with people who you describe who may not want to have a conversation about climate change, about patriotism and about lessening our reliance on foreign carbon-based energy fuel sources as one pathway towards decarbonization. This can be then cloaked in the language of national security and energy security as well. The list can go on and on, but I just gave you probably a number of ways that people can get to those discussions about climate change by not necessarily invoking it and then having people shut down.
When we think about who can use creative climate communication strategies, whether it's, you know, addressing people's religious values or their place-based concerns and values, or using a little bit more comedy. At one point in the introduction to your book, Creative Climate Communications, you almost kind of juxtapose media coverage with creative climate communication. Do you think that those two are mutually exclusive? Are these tools that the media could be using to perhaps reach new or broader audiences, or reach their audiences more effectively?
I do. Yeah. And I appreciate you making that connection. I've written this as a handbook or a guide. We're in a really different place than we were nearly 20 years ago, where there's so much great social sciences and humanities research that's going on that can help inform how, say, news media, for instance, can smarten up the way that they communicate about climate change and be more creative about that. There is this well-worn path of reporting on the latest scientific finding, but there are all these other underutilized paths. And it points to kind of one of the main arguments that I put forward in the book, is that there isn't a silver bullet to any of these communications. Instead, it's more of a silver buckshot approach that's needed to reach different audiences in different contexts. And so media actors can certainly, those people who are communicating through media can certainly use this. I hope they find it useful. Also, policy decision makers can find this of use. Anyone really who wants to contribute in this world and make a difference in the lives and in their communities, I hope will find this to be useful.
It's interesting that you use that phrase, there's no silver bullet, there's a silver buckshot of opportunities, because the same thing tends to be said about the technological potential solutions for climate change, that there's no one silver bullet. We're going to need a lot of different technologies and solutions. Do you think that is a unique aspect of the climate change challenge and why we've had such a hard time both communicating about it effectively and actually getting collective action to address climate change going?
I don't think it is unique. I think it's a good question to ask, but I think it's been the case with many critical issues that we've seen in the past that can help guide the way we engage with this set of critical and intersectional issues now. Looking to the past, there was no silver bullet, so to speak, that helped push for women's rights, that helped push for gay rights in the public arena, that helped push for racial equality. I mean, I guess I'm just giving some social examples, but it was a lot of work done by many different people in a variety of ways, using a variety of tactics and strategies. And so I really don't think that climate change is different. It is unique in other ways, in that it is the kind of issue that permeates just about every aspect of our lives, the way that we live, work, get around, relax, play. But I still think that we can learn from some of these past movements for change and movements for societal improvement to learn from them and more capably then address climate change.
Max Boykoff is an associate professor of environmental studies and director of the Center for Science and Technology Policy Research at the University of Colorado Boulder and author of Creative Climate Communications. Max, thanks.
Thank you very much.
Until next week, this is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab Radio is produced by WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio in Boston. It's produced by me, Elsa Partan, and Heather Goldstone is executive producer. Funding for Living Lab Radio comes from the Candida Fund, investing in transformative leaders and ideas. Theme music by Stellwagen Symphonette.